Hello and welcome back to Tyshar Menethrin Wheel of Time podcast. I'm Sam.
I'm Will.
We're here to discuss The Great Hunt, the second novel in the series. Bit of a do-over for us. We talked about this many moons ago and we're a bit all over the place. We were still kind of just reading books and talking about them. We weren't taking any kind of formal structured notes at the time. We were just like, this part of this book interests me, and then this other random part of this book moved me and probably spoiled some things. So if you listen to that one and were spoiled, here's your chance to be unspoiled, really.
That's how that works.
Yes. Forget all those spoils, spoilery thingies. If you feel so inclined, we have a donate button top of our website, tsmpodcast.com. You can do it one time or recurring as you see fit. No pressure at all. If you are not interested in donating, please continue to listen. So yeah, we're gonna kick this thing off and Will's gonna get us going.
Okay, so starting off with the prologue, in the shadow, right up front, we have a prologue. And this prologue is so funny to me because it refers to a dark friend social.
Just the fact that those words are together.
What kind of hors d'oeuvres do you serve at a dark friend social? Right. Does it all have to be like really macabre themed snacks?
Cheese puffs that are like shaped like skulls.
Exactly. Yeah. And you have name tags, like the "Hi, my name is" name tags with your dark friend alias. Your maiden
name. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. See, it kind of seems that way. They all know each other's dark friend names, but
yes. Hello, my name is man who calls himself Bors.
Right. Artist formerly known as not Bors.
But yes, speaking of this, this is from the perspective of a mystery character whose real name we don't learn in this chapter prologue. We only know that he calls himself Bors, and that point is driven home to the point that we can be certain that it is not his real name. Every single time it's mentioned, it's the man who calls himself Bors. Mm-hmm,
and mm-hmm. You are not the man who calls himself Will, typically.
So. Yes, exactly. So
I am the man who calls himself Trail Mix. No.
That would be an interesting choice. I'm the man who calls himself Juice Box. Yes. So it's safe to say, like, we're probably going to find out who this guy is, but it's not going to be for a while.
Yeah, no, not for a good while.
The first time I read this, I really had no clue what was going on in this scene.
I was really just hung up on the concept of a dark friend social even then. I was like, wait, what? What is even that? What?
And I have to say, on my second reading, I appreciated it more because I guess I didn't fully grasp that these were dark friends. I was confused because I thought they were actually forsaken. I thought this was like the dark one showing up and giving the forsaken orders.
Right.
But of course, rereading it multiple times now, I realized my clear confusion. And these are just lowly dark friends who are
socializing. Following.
Yeah. They're hanging out and they're getting orders from Baelzemon. So yes, in this scene, Baelzemon gives everyone instructions that are meant just for them. After showing images of Rand, Matt, and Perrin. Again, I thought that the title, like, of The Great Hunt referred to these guys, like, chasing the three Tavirin boys. And, of course, very soon...
It hadn't even occurred to me that's interesting.
Very soon we'll discover, you know...
what The Great Hunt really is.
That's not the case, yeah. Like many prologues in the first part of the series, you have to reread the scene later to fully appreciate everything that's happening and why, because they give you clues as to who these masked dark friends are, but you won't know that until you come back and reread it later. And so I do recommend rereading this later so you can appreciate who these people are and why.
That's true for a lot of the prologues, I would say. Like, you get a good chunk of the way into the book or even near the end, if you go back and read the prologue, suddenly it almost always is more meaningful. Like, if it's about some random character that's not one of the main characters, and certainly is the case here.
Exactly. Moving on from the prologue onto chapter one, The Flame of Tarvalin, which I believe, if I remember correctly, that's the title of episode, I believe, 5, maybe?
Right on.
So of the...
So perhaps episode 5, we begin The Great Hunt.
Yeah, maybe. We come to Rand, who is on the wall of Faldara Keep, which, by the way, is not, as I thought, the capital city of Shinar. It's just a city in Shinar. And I found this out when I was watching some Wheel of Time trivia thing where it was like, what's the capital city of Shinar? And somebody said what it was, and I'd never heard the name of it before. And you have to like go look it up in
the
Wheel of Time companion. It's just a large city in Shinar. Anyway, Rand is pretty much where we left him at the end of Eye of the World. Right at this moment, he's practicing sword forms with Lan. This is really our first introduction to the way the sword forms work. You get all the fun names of the different sword forms. And I just got to say, it's actually one of my favorite components of Jordan's writing.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout
it's
the fine, series.
For sure. It's not something you see in other fantasy.
Right. When I've attempted to write a scene, I try to go into this great detail of each blow by blow. But when he writes it, he doesn't even worry about crafting an exact mental image in everyone's mind. He just gives you the names of these forms, which is perfect.
Yeah, then you can come to your own conclusions.
Right. It's left to the reader to imagine what it looks like. And it might not be exactly what he's going for, but you have this like with a pretty specific mental image, even though it's like your specific mental image, and it makes every sword fight like sound awesome. It's like the sword fight version of not showing the monster. It allows your imagination to make the fight into whatever it's supposed to be in order to be as cool as possible to you.
Right.
So instead of saying he swiped up and to the left and the other guy jabbed over his head, it's like he performed the rising woodchuck and was met with moon over the water or whatever.
I don't remember the rising woodchuck, but I'm here for it.
Well, you know what? Having said all that, now it's time to play Inya Song or Sword Form.
Oh, Lord.
All right, Sam. The Dove Takes Flight. Is that an Inya Song or a Sword Form?
I'm going to go Inya Song.
No, that's a Sword Form.
Are you serious?
Yes. Soft Rain at Sunset. Is that an Inya Song or a Sword Form?
Inya Song.
Also a Sword Form. Watered Silk.
Inya Song.
Correct. Echoes in the Rain.
Inya Song.
Also correct. Fallen Embers.
Inya Song.
Also correct. Water Flows Downhill.
Sword Form.
Correct.
Hey, I'm getting better at this.
Yeah. Evening Falls.
Inya Song.
Correct. And River of Light.
Ooh. Inya Song?
Sword Form. Yeah. So Lan also explains that the blade Rand carries was probably made with the power, which is unusual these days. It's the Aes Sedai, actually, part of their three oaths is not to make weapons. So
right, yeah, he says that like there are some Harrenmark blades that are just normal swords, but there are some left over from the War of Power that were power rot weaponry.
So, you know, that's neat. Oh, also the wind does something weird.
Don't you hate it when that happens?
Where it like pushes Rand and like the wind gets all solid or something, and Lan like wails on Rand for a second with a practice sword, and he was like, "What's up with that?" And Rand was like, "I don't know, the wind got all solid." Lan's like, "Oh, I don't know. Things are weird this close to the Blight." and it's not 100% clear whether A, things are just weird this close to the Blight.
Right.
B, Rand was accidentally channeling. Or C, it was like one of these bubbles of evil, which we get later on. And if you're reading this for the first time, that's not a spoiler because you don't even know what I'm talking about.
True, true. You could be making that up like the Rising Woodchuck. Yes.
I recently watched Daniel Green's read along for The Great Hunt. He's been starting to do episodes about each book. And he mentioned this moment specifically and how it would be like a funny excuse if you're like playing a sport with some guys and be like, I don't know, the wind just got solid all of a sudden. And I'm totally going to use that next time I'm playing disc golf.
Absolutely.
And when I make a bad drive, oh, the wind did something strange there, this close to the Blight.
I became a dragon and buffeted me.
Then they hear commotion and Lynn's like, oh yeah, that'll be the Omerlin seat. You probably should have left a week ago, man. And so if you're reading this for the first time, contextually, it's pretty easy to figure out, but the Omerlin seat is the leader of the Aes Sedai because the Aes Sedai act as advisors to most of the rulers in the world. The Omerlin seat has political power that supersedes kings, queens, panarchs, firsts, councils of nine, lord captain commanders, high lords, and even clan chiefs. Basically, she's like the Pope. That's what you got to know about that. So it's like a huge deal for her to be here. And of course, Rand is concerned, and for reasons that aren't obvious, we'll get into them here in a second. So chapter two, the welcome. Rand runs back to his rooms, ostensibly to gather his things and vamoose. But when he arrives, he finds that all his clothes are being taken out by serving women. This sounds like a college prank to me. but it turns out that Moraine arranged for their wardrobes to be exchanged for newer, nicer clothes. And so he's forced to put on a fancier outfit.
Just those are my clothes.
Hey, wait a sec. Wait. He packs his bags and starts to leave, but on his way out, sees the Omerlin seat's entourage arriving. Lord Aglemar, who's a big, important guy, Shinar person, he welcomes her, and Rand isn't intent on getting away as soon as possible, but he's quickly informed that no one is allowed out of the keep now. So that's too bad. So on to chapter three, friends and enemies. You know, this was written back in like the late 80s, early 90s, when we didn't yet have the word frenemies. So could have saved some time.
Yeah.
Anyway, Rand talks about a few characters that we'll see more of, Uno and Massima, both Shinaran soldiers. Massima is unfriendly. Uno wears an eye patch and curses a lot.
That sums it up pretty well.
Yep. Massima and a soldier named Ragon won't let Rand past him to leave the city. He tries the other gates, but they're all guarded. So he's like, I'm not even going to ask. He thinks about trying to climb down the outside of the wall, but the outside of the wall is actually guarded just all the way around the perimeter. So there's really no way out.
Saw how well that worked for him in Camelin.
Yeah. And maybe if he had tried, he would have succeeded. Who knows? After running around trying to find a way out, he finally comes across Matt and Perrin and Loyal. They're all hanging out with some Shinarans, and Matt has discovered that he seems to have supernatural luck with the dice. Every time he's dices with these Shinarans.
Could have a great night playing some Yahtzee.
Yeah. Loyal talks a ton about Tavirin here, and if you didn't get a clear understanding of what Tavirin are to this point, then this is actually a really great chapter to get a very clear kind of over explanation of it. It's kind of, they make a joke out of Loyal going on and on about it. This is when Rand tries to employ the same strategy that John Lithgow tried at the end of Harry and the Hendersons, when he tries to convince Harry, go away, we don't want you here anymore, because he thinks that Harry will be safer. It kind of works in the moment. Perrin and Matt both get
pissed off.
They're
like, well, you're being a jerk, so we're gonna go, not leave, but we're just going to go over here now.
Yeah.
and not talk to you anymore.
Loyal's, the description of Loyal's reaction to Rand trying to run him off just is the, just sad. Sounds so sad. He's like a big kick puppy.
Right.
Then Egwene shows up and says that Rand is foolish for trying to scare the others off. Egwene, of course, knows that he can channel. The boys do not. So she says, hey, we should hide you in the dungeon. You know, right next to that super creepy guy who has admitted that he's a dark friend. Mm-hmm. So they head off to visit Padan Fain. On their way down to his cell, Egwene notices that the guards have gotten less friendly, as if there's some unseen force that's having an effect on them. So as you might expect, based on the last few times we saw him, Fain is super creepy. I like to think of Fain, you know, how D&D has the that morality alignment.
Yeah.
Chaotic, good, lawful good, neutral good, and then chaotic evil, mm-hmm. lawful evil. Fain is the chaotic evil.
Oh, yeah, 100%. 100%. You know?
And versus like the dark one is like the neutral evil. He's just like
white cloaks, you know, are like lawful evil.
Lawful evil.
Yeah, something like that.
And you have the same thing. You can go around with other characters and say, like, who's chaotic good.
There needs to be, like, an unpleasant for Elida.
Yeah.
Whatever. I don't know. There just needs to be an extra level of the continuum for people we just don't like.
Yeah.
Unlikable inept. There we go.
Yeah, there you go. Because there's a whole bunch of those. So, anyway, Egwene's like, maybe this wasn't a great idea after all. And Rand is like, you think? Importantly, Fane refers to himself in the third person as Mortis. So he's kind of going crazy. Then Egwene's like, new plan? Why didn't you hide in the women's apartments? And then we're in chapter 4, Summoned, a rare Moraine perspective.
Yeah, there's a couple of those in this book, and it keeps surprising me when it pops up. Like, oh, mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's more in this book. There's probably more in this book than almost any other book.
Yeah, for sure.
We actually get our first glimpse at Jordan's tendency to introduce several Aes Sedai at once.
this will happen again.
Yes. Often making it hard for us to keep up. These actually are important ones, though.
I feel like he was on a mission to introduce every Aes Sedai in the White Tower by the end of the series.
Right. Maybe he made a list of all their names and just really wanted you to know that by the end of the series.
Right.
So we meet Leandrin of the Red Aja. And as a reminder, the Red's job has been to hunt down and gentle men who can channel. So there is a reason to be cautious of Leandrin with Rand nearby, as their passion for gentling might override the possibility even that he's actually going to be, you know, the savior of the world. Red sisters are often cold and don't have time for other people who aren't Aes Sedai. So Moraine is intrigued when Leandrin wants to meet up with Lady Amelisa later for tea. Somewhere in here, it is mentioned that the Great Hunt of the Horn has been called an Ilion. And this isn't given a thorough explanation. Right here, you kind of have to put it together over the course of this book. But the Great Hunt is an event that is occasionally called an Ilion. It hasn't happened in a long time.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask. I couldn't remember when the last time it had happened was.
Yeah, I don't know if it was like hundreds of years something.
It's just
like
so weird because like you see hunters for the horn throughout the series and you just think of them as like another person in the world, but that's a recent development.
Exactly. When the hunt is called, young adventurers go to Ilion. They take an oath together. I picture it like a Burning Man kind of atmosphere when they take there's just like a huge crowd of people all like, yeah, let's take the oath. Woo! Yeah. And I'll get a tattoo to commemorate it. That's not in the books. That's just my headcanon.
That's my usual go-to. Let's go get tattoos.
then they all leave Ilion and go looking for the Horn of Valir, which is said to have the power to call the great heroes of the past back to life to fight for whomever sounds the horn.
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool if you could just blow on a trumpet and like Abraham Lincoln would show up with like a baseball bat on his shoulder?
Dude, I totally thought of Abraham Lincoln too. Like, yeah, just riding out of nowhere with like dual wielding axes or whatever.
Absolutely. It's the top hat. I guess it's the vampire hunter thing. But yeah,
probably that. But it's like, and it's he's not perfect. The obvious choice. Like you have like Alexander the Great, you know, some of these other guys that would be like, yeah, okay, yeah, that would be the obvious choice. But Abraham Lincoln showing up to fight for you,
then you know it's serious.
Right. Moraine goes to see the Ammerlin seat. She's been summoned. And briefly, we meet several more Aes Sedai. The main two that you'll want to remember are Alana and Varin. Both of these ladies will play significant roles for books to come. And I had totally forgotten that this was actually when we meet Alana. Alana, by the way, isn't to be confused with the Ammerlin's keeper, Lyanna.
This is a common problem where their names are way too similar.
Yes. Whose name seems similar, but it actually may be pronounced.
They're spelled differently, differently, but yeah, they sound, maybe sound similar. They certainly sound similar in my head.
Right. Well, and that's the way that the folks who read the audiobooks read them. But in the show, it sounds like they may be pronouncing it Leon A, which actually could very well be to draw the differentiation.
Yeah, that's, you know, got no problem with that.
The woman who'll be playing her, Jennifer Chiang Garcia, mentioned that in an interview. Moraine enters the room with the Ammerlin. Leone is in there as well. She's the keeper of the chronicles. This is like the Ammerlin's secretary, but also kind of her deputy. The Ammerlin seat herself is named Swan Sanche, and she's described as handsome rather than pretty. As Moraine enters the Armerlin's room, there's an air of formality and sternness to the woman. She indicates that the politics in the White Tower have kind of soured. The White Tower, I've referred to that, but I just want to be clear. White Tower is where the Aes Sedai, that's like their HQ. Yeah. And it's located in the city of Tarvalen. So we might refer to it as Tarvalen or the White Tower. It's the same place. And also people refer to the White Tower, meaning all the Aes Sedai as a collective.
Yeah, it's the Mage Guild,
Right.
It's exactly. The Mage Quests right there.
Yeah. And there you go. So yeah, politics in the White Tower have grown tense, that the power of the Armerlin seat has been weakening since Moraine last visited the tower. That's the political power, not her use of the one power. So after a moment, the Armerlin gives indication that she wants to give Moraine a thorough talking to and dismisses her keeper so that she can do so in private. So here we find out that Moraine and Swan Sanche are actually besties, something that most of the tower doesn't seem to remember or be aware of.
Maybe they knew that they were accepted together or novices together, but didn't realize that they'd stayed close and that they sort of intentionally have cultivated this air of separation between them, which is actually a trick that is employed again later. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of true. Funny.
You don't think about that.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I almost wanted to say more here about what I think will happen in the TV show, but I do think I did decide it was a little too spoilery.
Well, if you want to have a spoiler section, I had a couple things in a later one do that.
I've got plenty of things to talk about in a spoiler section. So if you want to hear about that, stick around for the spoiler section on my prediction on some changes that I think are going to be made to this scene based on other things that are in the book series. But this ends with Swan affirming that if anyone, including Lyanna, were to find out, they would be stilled, which means, of course, being cut off from the power.
Right.
So, chapter 5, The Shadow in Shinar. I like that alliteration.
I'm just thinking of the superhero, The Shadow. Yeah. He showed up in Shinar. It's a weird movie.
Played by Alec Baldwin.
Yes. Isn't it? So weird.
This and the previous chapter really do kind of run together at the start. There's times where I'm like, I'm not sure why they put the chapter break where they put it. I honestly don't remember if this happens in the previous chapter or in this one, but somewhere in here we find out that Moraine and Swan have been plotting since the early days of the tower to find and guide the Dragon Reborn. And so the fact that Swan is aiding Moraine and not telling, the Red Aja that there's a man who can channel,
yep,
or anybody else for that matter, she's not telling them. It's against tower law for them to just let a man who can channel run free. Mm-hmm. They could both get in a lot of trouble, but especially Swan as the Armerlin seat. They don't want to tell them because they're concerned that if Rand's discovered that he'll be taken to the tower, he may be gentled. And even if they do believe he is the Dragon Reborn, at least he would be shielded and imprisoned by the Reds.
It's such a weird concept, if there's a prophecy he's going to do something and they're worried he's going to be gentled. It's like, well, prophecy just could not come true. And then the shadow could fall across the pattern and the wheel can break. And I guess that's what they're basically worried about.
It's interesting because there is a real tug of war here on the amount of agency that mm-hmm. our characters have versus what they're compelled to do by the wheel.
Yeah.
It's very fluid. It's never overstated how much the wheel controls things.
Right. Yeah, and like Rand at one point talks to Matt about, when you're Tavirin and you try to resist, it doesn't work out. You just have to let it happen. Whatever's happen and just go, you're along for the ride kind of thing.
Right. At the same time, it's like, well, if that's the case, then you have this indication that Moraine and Swan at least believe that there is some needed agency on the part of the people involved in these prophecies to actually do things to make them happen.
Yeah, this is how things can go right, but things can still go wrong if something stops the prophecy from happening, like if Rand is murdered or gentled or whatever, then it just won't come true because he's not gonna be around anymore, and so
would put a damper on things.
Yeah.
Then Moraine presents Swan with a broken Quaendar seal, Quaendar or Heartstone is supposed to be indestructible. And this is looking pretty destructed.
So, if you, like me, read the books and didn't listen to the audiobooks and read it as Quaendar, you are forgiven for reading it as it is spelled, or Quaendar.
You know, it's interesting, and who knows? It's Quaendar is the way that.
I mean, I think that's right. It's just like Michael, if you didn't Kramer. Go bother to read the glossary and see all the pronunciations, there's a lot of made up words that it's easy to mispronounce if you're just reading it.
That's true. Some jerk would show up here and say, like, all words are made up. This is one of the seals on the Dark One's prison, and the fact that it has broken, not a great sign.
No.
Then they talk about Rand. Swan knows he's Tavirin, very strongly so, because she has the ability to see Tavirin. Although, how would she know unless she'd seen some Tavirin before?
Wait, maybe I missed this. Does she have, like, a talent capital T for this?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't, maybe I just, I don't know how I forgot that. Interesting.
Yeah, it's easy to miss because I don't think it even comes up after
I mean, you would think it, I mean, I guess they're,
it's a pretty, it's useless,
like,
talent.
Yeah, like we know the three Tavirin, and there aren't any others that I can think of that pop up relatively often in these books. So like it would have been really useful for those 20 years leading up to finding the three Tavirin, right, and then not useful at all.
Yep. So then we swapped to a random Jeffrey Bornhold point of view. Older guy, high ranking in the Children of the Light. And as far as White Cloaks go, Jeffrey is he really one of the more sympathetic ones, at least, you know, as far as they would go, you know. While he does see dark friends everywhere and sees it as his responsibility to bring a bunch of small towns to the light, he doesn't like the fact that he and his men are being used pieces on a stone board. That's stones is kind of like
checkers, maybe, or like go.
Yeah, I think it go. We also get the first mention of a certain invading army who is rumored to be moving in. And of course, they must be dark friends, according to Jeffrey. Anyway, the army is called the Seanchan, and we will hear all about them.
Oh, yes.
Later in this very book.
Indeed.
So then we get a Leandrin perspective. She meets up with Amalicia, makes some threats, and asks her if she's ever heard of the Black Aja. And I think this is the first time we get the Black Aja really talked about. Which, of course, is not, it's not a true Aes Sedai Aja in the sense that the others are, but rather a supposed super secret group of dark friends within the White Tower.
The first rule of the Black Aja is you don't talk about the Black Aja.
Yeah, exactly. Just the idea of the Black Aja is something that most Aes Sedai would deny it entirely, and they would never even bring it up at all, let alone confirm its existence, which Leandrin does here. Having the White Tower infiltrated by dark friends would be a pretty big embarrassment to the Aes Sedai, since they're also supposed to be serving.
They're
the
like
light.
Cockroaches, man. Dark friends are everywhere.
Yeah, it's true. Cockroaches in Florida. Leandrin uses something kind of compulsion like on Amalicia. All this serves, you know, it's like, needless to say, this seems very un-Aes Sedai like. And it serves to make us think Leandrin is acting pretty sus, as the kids say, or at least they did like 8 months ago.
I've never heard this. I don't hang out with a lot of like that age kids, though. My kids are too little to.
Yeah. Well, Among Us, were you aware of Among Us?
I was, yeah. And I didn't play it, so I guess that's why.
Yeah, it was real big in that. So
gotcha.
So this suspicion is reinforced as she thinks to herself that she's about to go follow orders that someone gave her. So we wrap up this chapter with a very brief Pot and Fame perspective. He's down in the dungeon being all creepy, dark friendy when someone shows up to rescue him, and we don't know who. Do we want to pause there?
Yeah, we're going to stop there and have a little spoilery discussion. So if you are reading The Great Hunt for the first time and you would not like to be spoiled by, I don't know, the rest of the series, check back in with us next week, where we will continue with chapter 6 of The Great Hunt.
Okay, so spoilers throughout this book, but it starts, I think, in chapter 3. We often are told that Rand is kind of arguing with a voice in his head.
Right.
And this is something that I didn't really notice much the first time I watched it, or the first time I listened to it or read it or whatever I did. It comes off just as kind of debating with himself.
Yeah, yeah.
But on rereading, it does make me wonder
if he was already kind of thinking about it being loose there in,
right,
in his head.
Right. And it does actually specifically say at one point that the voice in his head laughed at him, which does seem very...
That doesn't usually happen.
Right. Very Luz Theron-ish.
Yeah.
So the thing with Moraine and Swan, at first I was like, well, I'm going to have a slight New Spring spoiler here. But the subtext is present. And
yeah,
But then I was like, you know what? I better put this in the spoiler section.
Sure.
And I have to talk about this because... I do think that the way this is going to be played on the show, it's going to be pretty different. So we have confirmed in New Spring that Swan and Moraine were what Jordan likes to call pillow friends.
Okay. And yeah. Yes, that's right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And that is to say that they are what we might call like friends with benefits, which is not uncommon among the women of the tower.
Right.
I bring this up because I would put money on it that this moment, and I think it will be, where Swan dismisses Lyanna, makes it into the TV show, the second Lyanna hits the door, that Swan
and Moraine affection
will be making out or something,
or at least like more intimate, like hand on a cheek or something, maybe.
Yeah.
You can see it being like that, even potentially.
Right.
I mean, if they choose to play it up, then, you know, if they're in a passionate love affair, then sure. Certainly isn't the way the books portrayed it.
Right. Exactly. And that's why I say I don't exactly want it to happen, because it's not what the relationship is really. But I feel like based on what Rafe has said, that he's going to dial that kind of thing up a little bit.
Sure. Sure. That makes sense. I mean, 2021, man.
I'm saying this more to prepare myself and others who read the books and maybe didn't catch that subtext as much.
To be fair, I had forgotten. It's been so long since I read New Spring. It never even crossed my mind. And reading this book again, that was a thing. It is like this book. There's a Moraine perspective in one of my sections where she's talking to Lan about how they met and how they first got the bond. And it's like they talk about Nynaeve and she feels a stab of jealousy, and it's like, it is a little odd that, I mean, I guess generally blues don't marry their warders, but it is like, it's always felt a little bit like something was missing in this book. Like why they never had any sort of romantic interaction given how close they are and stuff. And of course, New Spring explores that a lot more, but it just felt a little bit unsatisfying in the way it's portrayed in this book.
The way I see it, and I see this in New Spring too, I think Moraine and Lan make good friends because they're similar in a lot of ways.
Right.
But I think they're too similar to be good romantic partners.
Mm-hmm.
That's my take on it anyway. Also, in that same chapter, there's a little bit of foreshadowing. Swan says, even if Lyanna were to find out, we would be stilled.
Yeah.
And... and it's funny because
Lyanna gets still too.
Yeah. The day Lyanna finds out,
Lyanna gets stilled.
Lyanna also gets stilled along with Swan. Oh, and another thought I had on this reading, and because it comes up in I think that same chapter, the hunt for the horn being called in Ilion. That's a little more interesting from the perspective that Samael is in power there. This time.
Yeah, I was wondering like when he would have taken power.
Yeah, I mean, it may not have been by this time, but if you were to suspect that he was at least in that area.
Y'all bring me the horn, please.
Yeah, basically. You know, of course he would go call for everyone to go out looking for the horn. Although the horn is interesting because when it shows up in the last trilogy and it gets sounded and Otter Hawkwing shows up and somebody says something to him like, okay, good. Glad we got it all worked out so that it wasn't sounded by a dark friend or something. And Otter Hawkwing's like, what do you mean? We wouldn't have ever fought for the dark.
Right.
And they're like, whoa, we thought that was the whole thing, which really kind of spoils some of the tension in this book.
Yeah. There's no chance that the Heroes of the Horn would just slaughter all the good guys.
You know, which makes me wonder, did the Forsaken know that? Right, right. They were just trying to keep it away.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Because it wouldn't have, you know, been of use to them, but they could have at least kept it out of the hands of the good guys, so to speak.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, Lanfear wouldn't shut up about how much glory and power it would bring Rand. So,
right.
If you have any thoughts, please check us out on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Podcast TSM. You can send us an email if you like, stuff@tsmpodcast.com. If you're so inclined, there's a donate button top left-hand corner of our website. Appreciative if you'd like to donate, but if not, it's all good. Until next time, Tyshar Manethrin.